From the campus of Maharshi University of Management, you are listening to World Radio KHOE 90.5 in Fairfield, Iowa. I'm Jessica Keen, and I'm the moderator this afternoon for a special broadcast on super radiance and the Maharshi effect. And this program was inspired by the Ideal Community Group in Fairfield. I'm here today with Dr. Mac Muehlman, Dr. Patricia Oates, and Dr. Richard Bell, each of whom are PhDs in Vedic science, and so we are in very enlightened company this afternoon. And we're looking to learn from them more about this Maharshi effect, this super radiance effect, and their history with it, how it works, why it is so essential right now for the future of society. World peace. I just wanted to start on this level, this highest level. This is actually kind of a founding goal, we could say, of MUM. And historically, there have been large assemblies here on campus, like the Taste of Utopia course and others like this. What has been your role in these large assemblies? Have you been present at these? I think it's 30 years ago, actually, the anniversary of the Taste of Utopia. Were you there? What was it like?
Yes, I think we were all there at Taste of Utopia course, and there were 8,000 people. And one of the amazing things about that course is that we managed to accommodate 8,000 people. Our campus was never prepared to accommodate that many people. And even though it was a very, very cold winter, and I think Maharshi announced that course in November of 1983, so it was 30 years ago almost, somehow what was then called, what was it called then? What is now the Recreation Center, and then it was called the Grand Assembly Hall, was built in less than 3 weeks. This enormous building that would itself hold 8,000 people so that Maharshi could come, and he came for that course, and he would sometimes lecture to the entire group while he was here, so it was extremely inspiring and quite remarkable. And the research shows that the effect was global from that course, because we had more than enough people for the square root of 1% of the world's population at that time. And consequently, crime went down around the world, accidents went down, hospital admissions went down, everything measurable, everything that the scientists could think of for that had open public data collected by the government so that it was equally available to all the scientists to verify. Everything went in a positive direction. Fires,
stock market improved.
Mm-hmm. Even war deaths in war-torn areas. Everything went in a positive direction. So we considered that that was, but above all, it was individually for all the people that participated in it. Many of us were 4 or 5 people per room by then, because we had so many people descending on Fairfield, and we needed to put them all up and accommodate them and feed them. But it was really, really fun. It was one of the highlights of our lives at that time. So we had a great, great time, and I think everyone felt that their individual life improved and was enhanced, and our lives tend to go more smoothly. But then there was this global effect as well.
Now, that was just one course. We've had other courses too, the Washington, D.C. course.
Yes, in 1993, 20 years ago, this is the other anniversary we're celebrating, we had a Washington, D.C. course. This was organized by Dr. John Hagelin, And at that course, again, there were enough people to affect. Was that for the world, or was that Washington, D.C.?
United States.
United States. So, again, the effect, measurable effect, the crime rate went down in Washington, D.C., and that's quite unheard of. And these studies were done very carefully using time series analysis to control for weather patterns. Normally, crime goes up in hot weather, and it got very hot on that course. Crime still went down. And many other studies showed the positive influence of that course. Would you like to talk about it, Mac?
Sure. The experience of that course was very unique and was inspiring to all of us to see how the United States could rise to the occasion, so to speak. And of course, it was very carefully orchestrated. Every aspect of what we expected to happen was announced ahead of time. And we contacted the FBI and said that we were going to reduce the crime rate. And their response was that the only way that we could reduce the crime rate by 10 or 15% would be to have 2 feet of snow fall, this being the middle of June. And so, there's a lot of disbelief, of course. But, you know, we went on our appointed way. And as it turned out, the crime rate went down, I think, about 22% or 23% during that time. And so the demonstration of the effectiveness of the project was really strong. It, as Patricia said, was done, analyzed through time series analysis. And there were about a half a dozen different institutions involved in analyzing the data so that it was completely independent. There wasn't any chance for some sort of bias in the data analysis. They used FBI statistics. The University of Texas and the University of Maryland were both involved in the analysis of the data. And the results are really favorable. It was a very strong study.
As I recall, you know, we had Taste of Utopia, and that was an impact on the world. And Mac, you mentioned you were on one of the groups that went out to hot spots around the world at Mars Ascent. And you saw in every one of those instances this reduction in the stresses or that area, whether it was war situations or crime or whatever. And so as I recall, the idea was, we're going to take this effect to the most, at that point, the most violent capital city in the world. I mean, Washington, D.C. had the most murders of any capital city. And so that was a very good test case.
You know,
gathered people from all over the world. Uh-huh. And we scattered, as you know, we were all probably in different universities. I had a great experience there because I was at Gallaudet University, which is a university for the deaf. And so we popped our culture into a very unique culture there during that course. And you know, there were helicopters flying over at night. They basically said, you know, just don't go off campus at all. It's a very dangerous area. But during that time, as you said, 22% reduction. And so it was, I think, referred to as a demonstration project to say, look, here we're gonna predict it, we're going to go in and do it, and then we're going to disperse, and you'll see the effect. And crime rate did go back up after everyone went home. Mm-hmm. So you kind of think, okay, well, how is this happening? What are the mechanics of this whole thing? And it really is challenging. And, you know, Patricia and her husband, Robert, have looked at the science response to this thing and how challenging it is for scientists to acknowledge it. But, you know, I think for me there's a very kind of simple analogy in an understanding this effect of consciousness. I go back over 100 years, and you've got this scientist who's tinkering away at his laboratory up in the top of his family's estate in Italy. And he's taking the technology of the time, and he's finding out what he can do with it. And he sends his mother out in the yard, and he says, hold this bell. And all of a sudden, the bell rings. And she's shocked, you know, what's going on. It's Marconi, and he continues to tinker. Now he goes on the other side of the hill, and here again, he can ring a bell from a distance through the ether, this invisible field. And his own father is skeptical about this until he sees it happen. And then Marconi goes to the Italian Navy, because he's a very chauvinistic guy. He says, this is going to give us a great strategic advantage, because now, you know, a ship goes from port. That's it. You know, it's the end of the story until they return. And so this will give us... they said, you're crazy. Mm-hmm. And they weren't interested at all. He had to go to England. And he continued his research there. He was able to cross the British the English Channel. He was able to cross the Atlantic. All of a sudden, Marconi is a household name. And now, nothing is more self-evident to us than the cell phones that we all carry around, that there's an electromagnetic field that's everywhere, all pervasive. And the theory behind this is very simple, is that consciousness, too, is a field. Just like electromagnetism, it's a field that permeates everywhere and everything, and each of us is both a transmitter and a receiver in that field, just like our cell phones are. And when that brain coherence happens for the individual, it has an effect, but what we understand from Maharshi and from the research is that when groups are together, it amplifies the power of that transmission from the group. And fortunately, the transmission is one, it seems, of kind of calmness, and positivity and reduction of stress in society, so that we see those effects like crime go down. So, you know, I think that there'll come a time, hopefully in our lifetimes, where we will see and understand consciousness as another field. Just as, in a way, surprising as electromagnetism was 100 years ago, but it'll be absolutely self-evident in the future that, of course, consciousness is a field. We hear anecdotal reports, you know, siblings have some, you know, kind of connection with each other. Mothers sense a child in distress. Sometimes people answering, you know, the other person's questions, finishing their thoughts. I think, you know, for us, this evidence that consciousness is a field is irrefutable. And I think that it's so interesting when Patricia was talking about the scientists when they were confronted with this. They basically couldn't say no because the research was so compelling.
That's right. And our culture has terminology embedded in it for just this phenomenon. Collective consciousness, for example, that's a well-known concept. And yet, it's the same thing that Richard has been talking about. It's the overall experience of the culture. And even in the field of the stock market or investments, there's this idea of investor climate. And that also contains the same underlying assumption that there's a feeling, a mood, feeling for the whole collection of individuals within some culture. And that's what we affect with our super radiance and contacting what is the basis of that, this field of pure consciousness, and creating less stress in the environment as a result. And that less stress creates this more orderly, more harmonious environment that Richard has been talking about.
And so, could we say that that the transcendental meditation technique then is a way of contacting that field of consciousness, that universal field, and that the TM City program somehow enlivens that field?
Yeah, kind of stirring the pot a little bit. Yeah, stirring mm-hmm. that wave of, you know, Marcy refers sometimes to pure consciousness as the individual waves settling down, so that you kind of the wave becomes as huge and as powerful as the entire ocean. And it's kind of what happens when the individual mind settles down to that quietness, and we have that full thing. But then, like you said, Mac, the TM City program really stirs it a little bit and gets it in motion. And I think, you know, in this case, has actually permeated out into the communities, whether it was Washington, D.C., the United States, or in 1983, the whole globe.
Maybe we can define super radiance, because we've used that word a couple times. And for those who might not know what it is,
super radiance is a term from the science of lasers. Inside a laser, there's a very precise organization which allows a single photon of light traveling through a larger group of atoms to become greatly amplified. This happens because other atoms spontaneously give off their light in a direction that is perfectly in step with the original photon. This is called the spontaneous stimulated emission of radiation, or just super radiance for short. but we know it as laser light. Super radiant laser light is highly coherent, orderly, and very powerful. These same precise dynamics also occur in consciousness. In a large group of people practicing the TM City program, like here in our domes, when even one person transcends and experiences the maximum brainwave coherence available in pure consciousness, the whole group spontaneously transcends and experiences that orderly, coherent brainwave state. And the whole group spontaneously then lifts off in a blissful wave of yogic flying. At the same time, a wave of coherence, harmony, and peace spontaneously radiates through the unbounded field of consciousness to the brains of everyone in the United States. We call this spontaneous radiance of coherence, super radiance. It causes all the measurable social effects that we've been talking about: less violence, less crime, more prosperity, fewer accidents, improved international relations, less terrorism, and less open warfare. The super radiance effect is often referred to as the Maharshi effect, in honor of Maharshi Mahesh Yogi, the originator of the TM City program, for his great contribution to national and world peace. Let me make it a little bit more clear. Super radiance during the group practice of the TM City program is dependent on two things. First, it's dependent upon the members of the group functioning at a very deep level of consciousness. In this case, from the level of pure consciousness, or the unified field. The deeper one goes in consciousness, the more powerful your thoughts become. In Maharshi's TM City program, you learn how to think and act from the deepest level of consciousness, the unified field of natural law, where thoughts gain complete purity and great power. The second thing that this effect is dependent upon is the size of the group. The power of the field, how shall I say this? The power of the group and its ability to super radiate grows according to the square of the number of people in the group. And this is true for any field, any unbounded, orderly field. And so we can find this happening in nature. For instance, when you have two loudspeakers playing music in synchrony, side by side, the amplitude of the wave is not just two times as great, but rather it's four times as great. It's the square. And in the case of radio broadcast, if you have three radio broadcast antennas side by side, the strength of the broadcast signal is not just three times, but it's nine times as great. Again, it's the N squared phenomena. And so this is called the N squared effect of constructive interference, which is a universal principle of field behavior. And we've already seen that consciousness is a universal field. And so this explains how a group of people, each experiencing the universal harmony in pure consciousness, produces an effect that grows according to the square of their number. Maharshi was the first to predict that the square root of 1% of a population practicing the TM City program together would be enough to create the super radiant effect throughout the whole population. For the U.S., that means that only 1,800 to 2,000 yogic flyers, a mere handful compared to the whole population, are needed in order to create super radiance and to create this measurable influence of orderliness, harmony, and peace throughout the entire U.S. population of 314 million people. You know, just to come to think of it, the experience of the super radiant waves that we experience in the domes when everybody spontaneously rises in coherence together, that blissful wave is a great reason for people to return to the dome and for all of us to practice the TM City program together. It's so nourishing. It's so revitalizing. I don't think I've ever experienced anything as refreshing here in Fairfield or as inspiring.
So what is the formula then for world peace?
Square root of 1% of the whole world's population, which is now, I mean, at Taste of Utopia was around 7,000 was the key, and we went way over. We busted that with the ceiling, had over 8,000 people together at one time. It's probably, around 8,000 now. And so that's the ultimate goal, is to have a permanent group of people infusing into our world consciousness, the collective consciousness that Patricia mentioned, that calming influence for the whole globe. But, you know, Marcy was also interested in having a number of those groups kind of in the poles, one in India, one in the United States, and more. And I think that right now we're looking at the possibility of Latin America leading that, because huge numbers of people that are learning and becoming Siddhas, people who practice this advanced TM City program there in Latin America. It's really exciting.
And interestingly, when these studies, Richard mentioned this before, when these studies are submitted to journals, peer-reviewed journals, some of the scientists are very reluctant to publish the studies because it's absolutely non-traditional concept to them. But we have a couple of quotes from different researchers commenting on. One, for example, says, this is the director of International Legal Studies Program at the University of Denver. He says, this is promising research. It is a non-traditional approach, but the methodology of these studies is sound and the statistical significance high. In a world as unstable and dangerous as ours, and this is why Dr. John Hagelin recently sent out an appeal for as many people as possible to come to the domes, especially at this time, because there are signs of instability and danger in the world at present. Anyway, this director says, I believe that any approach with such consistent, objective support deserves careful attention. And another professor, this is a professor of psychology at the University of Maine, Dr. Raymond Russ, says, the hypothesis definitely raised some eyebrows among our reviewers, but the statistical work was sound. The numbers were there. So in some cases, the reviewers, the peer review people, have some challenges with the research, but they often go ahead and publish it anyway, or recommend publishing it anyway, because the implications are so great for this research. If it happens to be true, then they want to not be the one to deny its possibility.
I'd just like to contrast that with a recent article that came out in The Intelligent Optimist, which is a very forward-thinking magazine. And it's this article called When Monks Rule, Rigorous Research Shows That Group Meditation Reduces Conflict and Violence in Society. Mm. And it's by Jurian Kemp, the editor of this magazine. And his conclusion is, the research is there. It's well-founded. He actually takes a visit. He comes to visit Fairfield to see what's going on, to see what's happening in our Golden Domes, as you mentioned, which are our halls of meditation. And he takes the research back to Peter Russell in Britain, and who says the results are solid. Let's accept them and live by them. Mm-hmm. Basically, let's move beyond the research at this point because there's enough. And I think, is there 50 studies? Is that right? Around 50 studies on
40 on 40 studies on the Maharshi effect.
And how many of them are peer reviewed? Because I know that's
important. I think about 20.
About 20. His conclusion then is the implications of the experiments are mind blowing. They show that we are capable of a consciousness revolution, and that our attention and intention matter. The sages have told us so for thousands of years. I remember thinking as I drove out of Fairfield. It is strange, but scientific proof does help to convince my mind.
It's true.
So if we have the research, it's convincing enough. Why, why aren't we able to produce the kinds of groups that are necessary to mitigate and diffuse situations that are clearly still happening in the world, such as the Syria conflict, which I think is very prevalent in people's minds? Why isn't it happening?
So just
It's just a choice. It's just a simple choice on the part of each person. And it's a simple thing, just beginning now. I'm going to, if I haven't started, I'm going to look into it and begin the steps of learning. And if I've already learned it, then it's just a matter of choosing today to go join that group and see what it's like. People, when they decide to finally go back to the program in the Dome, find it very inspiring and totally refreshing to be part of that experience. I know that's my experience from the Dome. There's an experience here that I thought I would read. It's from a doctor from New Jersey who says, "During yogic flying, I experienced increased clarity, inner silence, energy, exhilaration, and peace. Since I started yogic flying, I no longer feel that I'm aging or that my body is decaying. During yogic flying, the body gets enlivened through consciousness, and in this way, my mind and body become intimately coordinated. It's so profound that I sometimes wonder how people go through the day without it."
I think we've all had that question. And one thing I might mention, since a couple of references have been made to the domes, is that we do have other flying halls. We have a flying hall in town that opened up a couple of months ago. It's above Orpheum Theater, and people go there and love that group. And there's one for the people in Maharshi Vedic City. There's a flying hall there as well. So you can contact anyone.
It's very convenient.
Yes, very convenient for people to not have to come all the way to the domes if you'd rather not have to do that.
You know, it's a compelling question, Jessica. We've all kind of taken an angle on it. The accessibility is there. We have more domes. The research is there. The personal experience is there. You still think, why is it that, you know, we haven't been able to hear what people choose not to? And, you know, I think it's an interesting thing about human nature. I mean, most people have had a good night's sleep. They've gone to bed early and they've awoken the next day and been refreshed and thought, oh, that's good stuff. But we do that every day. Some do. Some are disciplined and do that. And others, you know that that's true, but they still don't do it. You know, we eat too much of something knowing that we're probably not going to feel well. So there's something built into human nature, free will. And so the other part that's built into to nature, I think, is a sense of responsibility and a sense of discipline and a sense of higher values and us becoming kind of more human in our sense of awareness of others and all. And I think that there's times when we simply have to step it up and recognize both the responsibility that we have to others and the power, which has been, you know, so well documented, of this collective practice. But the other thing is it's a reminder to us of how good it feels for us as an individual, you know, getting that deep rest and remembering that this amazing inner silent field that's there. It's just a powerful thing. And I just think these days, even more than 10 years ago, the outer temptations, the outter, I should refer to as object referral, all of our attention focusing outward, even more temptations like that now with our smartphones and all. Mm-hmm. So it takes smarter individuals than our smartphones. I mean, we have to be smart enough to say, I'm going to turn inside instead of focusing outside. For myself, my own advantage, and for the world, we just have to step up and do it, I think. And so, you know, making it accessible is helpful. Reminding ourselves of the research results and all, but really it boils down to the choice of free will. You mentioned choice, Mac, and I think that's spot on.
And you know, it's so easy to do now because the domes are so well kept, and there's people that their job is to make it comfortable in there. Yeah. So it's a lot easy now. It's very much easy. You finally find a space. There's always a nice foam ready for you, and everything is ready. All we need is to come.
Yeah.
A friend of mine recently told me that, in her opinion, people rarely go to the domes or to any other flying hall to create world peace. In her opinion, they come because they experience inner bliss and joy. and that's what attracts them. Nonetheless, I feel I should read this quote from Maharshi, who was the founder of the Transcendental Meditation Program and the TM City Program, about collective consciousness. All occurrences of violence, negativity, conflict, crises, or problems in any society are just the extensions of growth of stress in collective consciousness. When the level of stress becomes sufficiently great, it bursts out into external violence and war, or crime, accidents, and disorder. So it's good to keep that in mind, that you can go for your own benefits. Your day goes better, you feel better, you're happier. But a byproduct is you're having this effect of coherence and orderliness, more harmony in the whole environment.
You mentioned stress. It reminds me, we're celebrating the threes. Jessica said, you know, it's 1993 in Washington, 1983 in here in Fairfield, Taste of Utopia. We go back to 1973, mm-hmm. and Maharshi was in Chicago speaking to he was a keynote speaker, American Association for Higher Education. Huge hall there, thousands of people and all. And brilliant presentation of knowledge, the impact of being awake. For the field of education, novel concept for students and teachers to be wide awake in meditation. And he said, we have the formula. It's very clear what we have. He said, the key thing, the only thing that we need, the key ingredient here is we have to stay rested. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the other part of this is for us all, if we take that advice to heart, then, you know, we go to the domes not to sleep or to recharge in that way, but to really utilize the tremendous power of this program that we've been given. And that's something that we like to remind our teachers and students of at Maharshi School, that we have this amazing set of technologies from Maharshi and from this tradition that he came from, but we have to stay rested if we want to work. And so then the joy, wherever we do program, whether it's at home or it's in one of these domes collectively, that's certainly the priority. We'll get the most out of it.
Speaking of doing your program at home, I've noticed that there's quite a difference doing my program at home than doing in one of the flying halls. And maybe you can speak a little bit on that, because it's really a big difference. I fall asleep sometimes. So I don't do my program at home. I go to the dome.
Mm-hmm. I just remember that I have to say one comment on that. And this wave, this field effect of conscious. I think I've done over 10,000 meditations in the dome now.
Wow.
The last 30 years. Mm-hmm. But there's one that stands out for me. And it was on election night 2008 when Barack Obama was, mm-hmm. was running for president for the first time. And I remember going to the dome that night, not expecting anything different, but there was a big crowd there. There was a big group. Mm-hmm. And throughout that night, during the yogic flying portion of the program, there was just wave after wave of this exhilaration and huge energy and coherence. It was an amazing experience that night. So it was a program I'll never forget. Mm-hmm. And that wouldn't have happened at home. I wouldn't have had that experience there. So, it's amazing to plop yourself into that field effect.
That's the super radiance effect.
Yeah, in a place that's had millions, literally, very literally, millions of hours of transcending in those two domes.
It might be interesting to remember, too, that there have been many other super radiance demonstration projects, including a very long time ago. Maharshi sent men out to many of the hot spots in the world, including my husband went to Zambia for that because neighboring Rhodesia was in a civil war. And the day before they arrived, Lusaka, the capital city of Zambia, was bombed. And they just did their program. You know, people, when they're doing their program, aren't thinking about world peace. They just do their program, and world peace is an innocent byproduct of that. Anyway, when they were doing their program, there were people sent from the government to watch them and see what they were doing. My husband said it was must have been one of the most boring jobs imaginable because, yes, they had their eyes closed, and yes, they had their eyes closed, and yes, they had their eyes closed. But eventually, after a few weeks, government officials visited the group and asked them, could they please stay through the elections, because they were getting ready to leave. Could they please stay through the elections? Only about half of them could. So Maharshi made their program even richer to compensate for that fact. Anyway, consequently, the elections were quite peaceful for the first time in decades. And then they left Zambia, and the next day the city was bombed again. It wasn't bombed the entire time this group was there, and that city, that story is replicated by all these different places where people were sent. Iran, Nicaragua, Thailand, I can't remember what all those places were.
These stories are so thrilling to hear for me. I'm of Generation Y, so, you know, I grew up in the 80s. And so for me to hear about all that is being done and all these demonstration projects, it's just really inspiring. But it seems like at some point, if we can look at the history of the TM City program as this peace-creating technology, at some point we went from this goal of demonstrating the effect to wanting to have permanent groups or established groups in places. And why is that?
It was Maharshi's idea. He got tired of seeing the population return to the old stressful ways. And so he said, no more demonstration projects. In fact, that 1993 project, he had to be talked into that, because he had previously said no more demonstration projects, because when we withdraw, we see the resumption of the negativity. And he didn't want to see that anymore. He just wanted there to be a permanent group to create peace and harmony in the world.
You know, it's really interesting you think about Maharshi as a person. You know, here's somebody who was a physics major in his university. So we talk about consciousness as a field, and he very much was, you know, a foot in the Eastern, you know, traditions of developing those inner resources, but also in the Western sense of documenting those. And that's really what we're talking about so much of this here, is he wanted very much to be able to show that these effects of consciousness were measurable and reliable. And so he, as a scientist, you know, he was kind of creating these experimental conditions. But I think as a humanitarian, it was enough. You know, it's too much to put a group in, pacify for a while, and pull them out. And so clearly I think his attention in more recent years was on those permanent groups, whether they be, you know, in Fairfield or with the Vedic pundits in Vedic City or in India or in Brahmastan there or wherever. That became the priority. So I think it was really that. The scientist role had been satisfied, in a sense, with Washington, D.C. You get, as Max said, you get all the people on board, the sheriff's department, the University of Maryland, all these people. You prove it. And then after that, you know, it's that humanitarian that needs to see this permanently established. So
that's really beautiful. I guess then this enters onto the scene, the Invincible America Assembly, which began in 2006. Is that right?
That is right.
Mac, do you want to tell us how that started and what the goals are?
Well, there had always been, of course, the goal in the United States of establishing a super radiance group. And in fact, you know, even back in the 80s, people were talking about how can we make this a permanent reality? How can we become a funded professional group and thereby, you know, continually stay on instead of just having enough money for 1 month or something like that? And beginning somewhere around 2006, there were the support came from two directions. There became, in the United States, it became possible for one family to donate in the neighborhood of $12 million a year to sustain a large group, to sustain a group of 2,000 here. And then the other wave of support was, of course, we had about 1,000 or 1,200 from the United States that wanted to participate in that, but we needed more. And it ended up that we got a wave of support, which was unprecedented, where the Vedic pundits of India were given permission, actually, by their teachers and by their government to come and participate in this endeavor, because it would actually be so good for the United States. And this is sort of the nature of India. It supports the well-being of the world. And when the government saw that possibility, and they knew how conscientious Maharshi was in creating a pure, simple, and good environment for those pundits, they, for the first time in history, never in 10,000 years have the Vedic pundits left India as a group. And so we had about 1,000, anywhere from 600 to over 1,000 Vedic pundits here at different times. And we still have a large group of, you know, I'm not sure how many.
Over 600.
About 600. Mm-hmm. And so the support came from both the East and the West. It was as though wholeness of collective consciousness was functioning. There was a holistic solution that came from both the East as well as the support of a very wealthy family here in the United States. So we're very grateful for both of those ways of support. Mm.
You say Vedic pundits. What are Vedic pundits?
The Vedic pundit tradition is a very ancient tradition that goes back as far as anyone knows. As Maharshi is fond of saying, it's as old as the universe itself. As long as human beings have been here, there have been people that are expert in Vedic knowledge, and they have from birth been trained to pronounce all the different verses of the Ved perfectly, which is essential to their profession. The pronunciation of the Vedic hymns in different areas of the Vedic knowledge are essential to each one of the different areas of Vedic understanding. And so we have here represented many different areas of Vedic knowledge, and all of them have had the traditional learning, traditional education, which is a lifelong practice. And it's one that's handed down from father to son, and for as long as can be remembered. And it's that purity of maintaining the lineage within the family that keeps the pronunciation of the verses also pure and allows them to be effective, so that they can create through their own pronunciation a wave of purification wherever and whenever it's needed. And so this is a speciality of our group of Vedic pundits. They not only can create this wave of coherence in society through their use of the Vedic verses, but they also practice Maharshi's Transcendental Meditation and TM City program, and so they can create that effect through their group practice as well. It's a very powerful group, and we're very grateful to what they brought the United States.
Sounds like a booster to our Maharshi effect. Mm. It's not only the practice of yoga in terms of the coherence that is generated from the TM City program and yogic flying, but it's the sound element also.
Yes, yes.
And probably from some pretty pure nervous systems, anyway.
Mm. Right.
I mean, coming from a life that was really always connected with that inward side of experience. And so not maybe quite as stressed as some of us Americans might be, and being able to generate more coherence, as individuals. So as Max said, it's been a great blessing to have them here. And,
powerful group.
And they're sort of out of sight, here, but mm-hmm. I think never out of the influence that they create in Fairfield and the kind of calm that we swim in here.
Yeah, I think that's a really tangible image. I think a lot of people experience that calmness, that sweetness, that liveliness from being in this environment if they visit here or if they you know, live here. I just moved here a few years ago, and yeah, I mean, it's why I call it my home. It just feels very comfortable, very familiar, very warm and loving. And
you remember the impact when you first came?
Yeah, let me think. Well, I came actually to join this Invincible America Assembly. I just finished my master's degree in international development studies. I wanted to change the world, and so I went to university to learn how to do that and learn not all that much, you know, in terms of a really practical technology, and then really discovered that, well, the technology had always been there in my own practice of TM and my own practice of the TM City program. Mm. And so joining the group was a very powerful thing for me. And it was this feeling of just being at home. And the dome really gave that sense that, okay, well, this is my home in consciousness right here. And I shouldn't really go anywhere else because this is the most powerful thing for me and really for the whole world. So I feel really blessed to be here like all of you.
Well, it's great to hear your appreciation, Jessica. And I think that the interesting thing is that, you know, Dr. Mealman, Dr. Oates, and I all come from, I think, a little different generation.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
We're handing the baton off to you.
Yeah.
And we're very, very pleased that there are such bright, you know, kind of shining examples of recognition for what we have here, especially coming out of the academic study that you did, and to say, wait a minute, there's a second. Now, Marcy referred to this idea of a second element that, you know,
right.
You can't solve the problem on the level of the problem, and so the idea of bringing in another element to the situation, and that's certainly, for anybody who's, you know, spent their life endeavoring for world peace in one way or another through negotiations or that, to see that there's this completely different approach is really refreshing and promising.
Mm. So. I love this point that you made earlier about responsibility. Mm. And I wonder, you know, what kind of a responsibility is it? If we could sort of like give it a color and a name and make it, you know, what kind of responsibility is it? Because if we're awake enough, as someone else mentioned, if we know that we have the knowledge, if we have this technology, we're clearly you know, cognizant of the powerfulness of it, then is it a burden? Is it a lightweight? Is it, you know, is it just something? How would you describe that responsibility?
Well, you know, you think of different societies, and they interpret responsibility in different ways, but always, I think, with connection to this idea of service.
Mm.
So you think of certain religions who tithe. That's part of the way that they give back. Is they going to give 10% of their, you know, gross income to, you know, charity of their choice, something like that. You know, other societies where the families are multi-generational, families are together, services through your elders to a large extent, taking care of family and all that. And I just think that, you know, Marcy, we have this very familiar expression, Vasudeva Kutumbakam, world is my family. And I think that for us, I would just love for people to everyone who's got the TM City program and who always has such an amazing initial experience with that. My wife, Andrea, and I get to go each year when there's a CIC course, Creative Invincibility, Center Invincibility course. Anyway, where the people learn a TM City program, and you see them just on fire. You know, they're just, their eyes are just sparkling. They're having such a great experience there. And then, you know, we get away from that group, and life gets in the way, and we may forget. But I just think that for all of us, that sense that this is a way to serve. Mm. This is a sense that, and an amazing thing about it is that it's no real sacrifice, opposite of a sacrifice, because we're gaining so much as individuals. But it's just, it's a powerful way to serve and be, set that as a family tradition. You know, where other families, other cultures have their own traditions, this can be our tradition. Is you just, you find a way to do super radiance as often as you can. And we understand that there are family responsibilities and occasion work responsibilities and all, but as often as people can to be there and do that as a service to society. That's kind of my take on it.
That's beautiful. I always remember Marcy talking about those who have the knowledge, they have a parental role for society. Beautiful. Does that resonate with you? Do you feel like you're the parents or the, you know?
The parent. I feel like I'm the participant. To me, the whole thing is sort of a festival. This is the amazing thing that that happens, in at least in my experience, that when we get enough people together, that the experience here in Fairfield, whether it's in the dome or outside the dome, becomes one of a celebration. It becomes a festival, and I noticed this happening when the Invincible America Assembly first started. That when we had a large group, I think we were, you know, had somewhere around 1,800, 2,000, right in the very start of the whole thing. And the life in town took on a celebratory sort of experience. And I was so grateful for the transformation that happened, you know, to my little town. All of a sudden, it was a festival of love and peace, where I could enjoy life so much more with my friends. And so, to me, the inspiration, just like Richard was saying, the inspiration sort of takes over, and it doesn't become so much of a responsibility. You become like you're participating in this, almost a game. You know, it's like a, it's a festival.
Or maybe in sort of people of my generation, their terms, join the party.
That's good.
Come on out. So on that note, you're all invited to the party here in Fairfield, Iowa, on the campus of Marshy University of Management. It's been my great honor and privilege to spend time this afternoon with Dr. Richard Bell, Dr. Patricia Oates, and Dr. Mac Muehlman. Thank you all so much for coming in. And thank you for listening to KHOE and to the program What's New on Campus. This is Jessica Keen. Thank you and good afternoon.
Jay Goodell. Thank you.
Thank you.